is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 27, 2006. I'm Nell Abram, sitting in for Ada Bolgado. World leaders react today to the stunning victory by Hamas in this week's Palestinian elections. President Bush weighs in.
The United States does not support political parties that want to destroy our ally Israel.
Democrats are increasingly pressured to filibuster the Supreme Court nomination of Samuel Alito. And as the World Social Forum continues in Caracas, we'll take a look at a community of youth in the Niger Delta who are taking on multinational oil companies.
What they are there to do in Davos is that you have all the CEOs in the world, you have the Shell, you have the ExxonMobil, you have Chevron, and the rest of them. They are sitting down to see how they are going to take the wealth of Africa and take them back to their vaults in Europe and in America.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Hundreds of Fatah supporters took to the streets of Gaza City today, protesting their party's loss in the historic legislative elections and calling for the resignation of the Fatah leadership. In Gaza City, Leila Al-Haddad has the story.
The mob of young supporters, which included the militant wing of Fatah, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, marched throughout the city's streets, shooting wildly into the air and blaming the Fatah leadership for the crushing blow in the elections. In front of his Gaza residence, they gave Mahmoud Abbas 3 days to resign, accusing him of being an Israeli agent. They then swarmed the Legislative Council, burning government vans, scaling the walls of buildings, and yanking out air conditioners and wires from its exterior. Mohamed Dahlan, one of the few Fatah leaders to win a seat in the district of Khan Yunis, and a very popular Fatah leader among supporters, came out to calm down the angry mob. He assured them Fatah would always be the first Palestinian revolutionary movement, despite other groups' attempts to conspire against it, before being whisked away by his bodyguards. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
We'll have more on reactions to the Palestinian elections later in the newscast. Heavy snowfalls have worsened Georgia's week-long energy crisis, which began when explosions in southern Russia damaged two gas pipelines on Sunday. From Tbilisi, Georgia, Deborah Wild has the latest.
Yesterday, a high-voltage power line in western Georgia collapsed under the heavy snow, leaving eastern Georgia without electricity. This comes at a very bad time. On Tuesday, Georgia's Minister of Energy had warned that Georgia's energy system was operating, quote, without any reserve resources of electricity, unquote. Many shops or businesses are closed, and public transportation has become scarce due to unsafe driving conditions. The worsening of this crisis has prompted President Mikhail Saakashvili to break off his visit to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and return home. Georgians who have neither gas nor electricity have had to switch to kerosene heaters or wood ovens. The Ukraine has donated funds for the purchase of diesel fuel from Azerbaijan. President Saakashvili announced today that Iran has agreed to supply gas via Azerbaijan starting on Monday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Deborah Wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
In Washington, the Abramoff scandal has led to lobbying reform proposals from both parties. Meanwhile, a poll by The Washington Post shows most Americans want President Bush to fully disclose his ties to the disgraced lobbyists. In Washington, D.C., Quinn Bowman reports.
Congressional Democrats are pouncing on the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal, using the criminal Republican super lobbyist as the poster boy for a slew of lobbying reform proposals. Last week, congressional Democrats proposed tighter rules for lobbyists, a day after Republicans offered similar proposals. Both proposals would make it illegal for lobbyists to buy meals or finance trips for members of Congress. Abramoff has also been linked to the Bush administration through his fundraising efforts and his ties to a Bush administration official who was accused of lying to federal investigators about his dealings with the lobbyist. In a poll published today by the Washington Post, 76% of the respondents said that Bush should reveal his administration's relationship with Abramoff, which Bush has thus far refused to do. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Quinn Bowman in Washington, D.C.
Congress will soon be expected to vote on expiring provisions of the USA Patriot Act. But as Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle, legislators may not be fully aware of all of the provisions.
According to the American Civil Liberties Union, a proposed change to the USA Patriot Act would allow the federal government to designate restricted zones at any events considered to be of national significance. The ACLU's Council for National Security Policy, Tim Edgars, says the provision was slipped into the reauthorization bill at the request of the Secret Service, without the knowledge of most members of Congress or the media.
The problem here is that Congress is considering, without any debate, without having considered it in either the House or the Senate, a major expansion of the Secret Service's ability to impose these exclusion zones that have been used to harass clearly legitimate protesters.
Exclusion zones became a controversial issue in the U.S. during the 1999 World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference in Seattle, when authorities established a large no-protest zone near the conference site. This move resulted in a major class-action lawsuit for violations of the First Amendment. The ACLU is concerned that the new measure would fully legalize restrictions on the constitutionally protected activity of peaceful assembly and the exercise of free speech. Congress is expected to vote on the reauthorization of the Patriot Act by February 2nd. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
Bolivian President Evo Morales ends his first week of government with two significant moves. Dileta Varlese reports from Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
Soon after his inauguration, President Evo Morales appointed several well-known activists to cabinet-level positions. The new Minister of Water, Abel Mamani, is the former leader of an Haberud organization that expelled a French multinational corporation from the impoverished city of El Alto for failure to deliver water services. Hydrocarbons Minister Andrés Solís Rada is a lawyer and a journalist who has spent 30 years defending Bolivia's natural resources. President Morales ended his first week in office by reducing his salary by 50%. He will now earn slightly less than $1,900 a month. The pay cut will affect most high-ranking office holders, as no government employee in Bolivia is allowed to make more than the president. The new step for the new administration will be to start the discussion on reforms to the country's hydrocarbons law. For First Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese from Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Liberal groups are capitalizing on the F word. Filibuster. They are coming out in unison and urging Democrats to follow Senator John Kerry's lead and block the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. But as Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill, some Democrats won't go down that road.
Confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito Jr. is expected, but progressive groups are shouting loudly for a filibuster. Elliot Minsberg is vice president and legal director for People for the American Way.
It's reproductive rights. It's cutting down on Congress's authority. There's a case this year that he could be the deciding vote on that could strip the Clean Water Act of its protection over 90% or more of a lot of our nation's waterways. There's civil rights. There's trying to restrain executive power. On all of these issues, Alito has staked out positions that are extremely dangerous.
But the widespread call for a filibuster, the move to block a vote, didn't begin until yesterday, 2 days into the confirmation debate on the Senate floor. Again, Minsberg.
Frankly, it had been our hope that it might be possible to get enough people to vote him down to prevent him from getting on the Supreme Court. But from our perspective, filibuster has always been on the table and never off the table.
People for the American Way have been one of the first groups to come out. You've been done extensive research on Alito, but I never really did see the word filibuster.
Because our view was we felt it was critical that Alito be stopped from being on the Supreme Court by all appropriate means. What exactly the right way to do that is depends on the circumstances.
Many groups were calling for any means necessary to stop Judge Alito, but the apparent catalyst to filibuster began yesterday when the New York Times published an editorial titled "Senators in Need of a Spine," which was referring to Democrats' position on President Bush's conservative nominee, Judge Alito. Later in the day, Democratic Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts, presidential candidate in 2004 and likely candidate in 2008, called for the vote-blocking move.
This impact is going to be now. This choice is now. And this ideological direction is defined now.
He was backed immediately by fellow Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy and Democratic Whip Richard Durbin from Illinois. A large number of opposition votes were expected against Alito, but Democrats have not come out in unilateral support for the filibuster. At airtime, roughly 24 Democrats support the move, leaving about 20 who are either undecided or have come out against it.
I have concluded I cannot justify a filibuster in this case.
Democrat Kent Conrad from North Dakota made his announcement this morning after a meeting with Alito. He cited overwhelming support by the American Bar Association as one of his deciding factors. Republicans are confident that the filibuster attempt will fail, and Democratic leadership also believes Alito will be confirmed. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama spoke on the Senate floor about Senator Kerry in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, where he made the announcement for a filibuster.
Maybe they ought to spend more time trying to get the oil prices, gasoline prices down than worrying about conjuring up a filibuster of a judge as able as Judge Alito.
Four Democrats have joined all 55 Republicans in blocking the filibuster, which means that coalition only needs one more. That vote will take place Monday night. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
At a White House press conference yesterday outlining next Tuesday's State of the Union speech, President George W. Bush also commented on the landslide victory by Hamas in this week's Palestinian parliamentary elections. Selena Masuda reports from Washington, D.C.
The ending of the four-decade rule of the Fatah government after losing to Hamas this week has shocked and disappointed high-ranking officials in the Israeli and United States government. Israel has stated that they will not continue with peace talks if Hamas is involved. Bush told reporters that he would not work with Hamas unless the party recognizes Israel's right to exist as a state.
The United States does not support political parties that want to destroy our ally Israel, and that people must renounce that part of their platform.
Bush also urged Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to stay in his position in hopes that the elections prove that the Palestinian people are tired of corruption in the current government.
They want to be able to raise their children in an environment in which they can get a decent education and they can find health care. And so the elections should open the eyes of the old guard there in the Palestinian territories.
Some Washington analysts, like Samar Assad, believe that the discontent over the lack of social services is only one of the major reasons why Hamas won. Assad is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Palestine Center.
It didn't reform government performance. It didn't provide transparency, which is true. But however, there is also a lot to be blamed on Israel and, by extension, the United States for weakening the Fatah-led government and President Abbas on the political international level. And that came through Israel's policies of unilateralism, dictates, and facts on the ground.
Bush has argued that the United States does not recognize parties that have armed wings. Phyllis Bennett, an Institute for Policy Studies fellow, finds the United States' stance on Hamas hypocritical.
The Bush administration talks about the incompatibility of participating in parliament and having an armed militia. What he ignores, of course, is not only that Palestinian Authority has always had parties within it, including Fatah, that have armed militias as well as participation in the parliament, but also, if he would look at Iraq, at his favorite government in the region, the Shia and Kurdish parties, the powerful parties that control that government, are all characterized by parallel armed militias.
For now, Hamas has said they will focus their energies and resources on domestic social service issues. Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
4.5 months after Hurricane Katrina, health professionals say that New Orleans is still in a crisis. Small clinics, often volunteer-run, are scrambling to fill gaps in care that many say existed even before the storm. Christian Roseland reports.
The clinic in a small pink and white house on Claiborne Street in the 9th Ward is closed on Fridays, but a woman from the neighborhood showed up anyway to ask staff undergoing training where to find care for a friend who had been beaten. According to volunteer Barbara Wynn, the woman is one of many who shows up on the doorstep of the 9th Ward Common Ground Clinic, some of whom have not had access to health care for months.
And a lot of people since the storm haven't had their medication or got their medication in Mississippi or Alabama or Atlanta or all the other various places, but now that they're coming back and forth to New Orleans, haven't actually had an opportunity to see someone in New Orleans.
Only one hospital, Touro Infirmary, has reopened since Hurricane Katrina inside city limits, forcing many to seek medical care in neighboring Jefferson Parish or at one of the small clinics, some of which existed before the storm. But Wynn points out that neither her clinic nor others in the city have the facilities to deal with the problems that many patients have.
There is no lab work. Like, we can't actually take somebody's blood and do lab work there. So that's one of the big differences. We're able to do herbal medicine, but we're not able to, in some cases, change prescription as far as, like, say, blood pressure medication is concerned. As far as, like, the whole city is concerned, that's problematic as well. Going from emergency care to actual primary care.
The federal government announced Wednesday that it would give tens of millions of dollars to reopen part of University Hospital, a part of the state's system of care for the poor, in the fall. Administrators in the state government are still deciding the fate of Charity Hospital, the facility across the street from University Hospital that cared for the bulk of the city's indigent population and provided high-level trauma care. In the interim, a tent hospital has been operating out of the city's convention center to supply some of the services available before the storm, dubbed Spirit of Charity. Dr. Renee Morrissey, a doctor who worked at Charity Hospital during the flood, says doctors at the tent hospital are starting to take a stand about the city's current inadequate facilities.
The residents in the emergency department have filed a formal petition to the LSU higher-ups, voicing their displeasure with their training as well as the medical care that they're providing to patients based on the fact that they're operating out of a tent without any long-term treatment facilities. It's a crisis already, and it's going to just be worse unless something comes up really quickly.
The Convention Center Tent Hospital is scheduled to close March 1st, and administrators have not said what will happen between that date and the fall when university is set to reopen. In the meantime, Common Ground Clinic continues to operate with a staff of out-of-state volunteers and a small number of Louisiana doctors, who are in short supply. Barbara Wynn says the state of Louisiana continues to extend the deadline for out-of-state doctors to practice, many of whom are filling the gaps in a system that remains broken. For FSRN, this is Christian Roseland.
Top politicians and business leaders from around the world concluded their annual economic forum in Davos, Switzerland. The primary agenda was to promote big business and globalization. In Mali and Venezuela, civil society groups opposed to these ideals held an alternative forum to seek global solutions based on human rights and respect for the environment. This comes at a time when armed youths in Nigeria's Niger Delta region are taking on some of the largest multinational oil corporations in the world to protest more than four decades of pollution and economic marginalization. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The armed youths have in the last 3 weeks attacked several oil installations in the Niger Delta. The world's largest oil company, Shell Petroleum, has borne the brunt of the attacks. Even though billions of dollars is made yearly from the Niger Delta, the people remain some of the poorest in the world. Edward Onofe says the general anger in the Niger Delta is the result of poverty among a people that should potentially be some of the richest in the world.
Poverty is still responsible for these things. We produce this oil. Look at Niger Delta that produces oil. We have nothing to write home about. And we are oil producing area. So it's total neglect and act of poverty. The people are very poor. They have nothing to eat.
While poverty bites harder in the Niger Delta, many countries like the United States rely on the region for some of their oil supplies. China has also shown interest in the region. Bode Olufemi, a member of the Social Forum, says the Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, is designed to perpetrate the kind of imbalance in the Niger Delta.
What they are there to do in Davos is that you have all the CEOs in the world, you have the Shell, you have the ExxonMobil, you have Chevron, and the rest of them. They are sitting down to see how they are going to take the wealth of Africa and take them back to their vaults in Europe and in the America.
Nigeria's President Olusegun Obasanjo, who was at the Economic Forum, has sent hundreds of troops to the Niger Delta to protect oil installations. But many, like Alhaji Asare Dokubo, who leads a separatist group in the Niger Delta, says protecting the installation will be a difficult task given the swampy terrain in the region.
The Nigerian government cannot protect all the pipelines. If somebody boasts that they can protect all the pipelines that crisscross the Niger Delta, the person is a liar and maybe does not know the topography of the area.
Faced with such difficulty, the troops vent their anger on local people. Thousands of people have been killed in recent years. There are fears the fresh deployment of troops to the region may lead to further bloodshed. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in the Niger Delta.
It's Brother Cornel West. I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice.
The historic human rights group Mothers of Plaza de Mayo yesterday concluded the last of the annual 24-hour protests they've held for 25 years. The president of the Mothers, Hebe de Bonafini, decided to drop the annual March of Resistance because they no longer have an enemy in the presidential palace. Marie Trigona has the story.
The Mothers of Plaza de Mayo completed their 1,500th consecutive round in a plaza enveloped in banners and photos of Argentina's disappeared yesterday. The Mothers, many now in their 80s, drew to a close a chapter in the struggle for human rights as they completed their last 24-hour annual resistance march. The Mothers said that they will continue with their weekly protest in the Plaza de Mayo, where they have met to demand justice for their children disappeared during Argentina's dictatorship. The Mothers began their protest in 1977 to demand information on the whereabouts of their children from authorities. Some 30,000 activists were kidnapped and murdered during the military junta dictatorship, which ruled Argentina from 1976 to 1983. Sarah Brad, a mother from Tucumán, said that the Mothers' 29 years of struggle will continue in the spirit of her 30,000 children.
Bueno, para las madres es una marcha que...
For the Mothers, the resistance march is an act that's important because our long fight has been a permanent resistance and protest against human rights violations. The Mothers were born out of our children's fight, from their ideals and their hope for a better world. We think that their struggle is more important and relevant than ever. This is the last resistance march, but we are going to go to the plaza every Thursday like always. Our fight will continue in other spaces, but always with the same strength. We are never going to put our arms down. The only fight that is lost is the one that you give up.
This year's resistance march was dedicated to the worker-operated recuperated factories in Latin America. Musicians like Leon Hirko also performed to commemorate Argentina's disappeared. Many mothers admitted that a quarter of a century of fighting was also a factor in the decision to stop marching. The mothers' decision to conclude the resistance march provoked a polemic debate among human rights groups. Many social organizations have criticized the Mothers for applauding current President Néstor Kirchner rather than pushing for further reforms. Mercedes Maroño, vice president of the Mothers Association, said that Latin Americans now have the opportunity to guide their governments.
The resistance march means what it says, to resist. We started this march in 1981 at the height of the dictatorship. We continued this protest even during democratically elected governments because they were also our enemies. Do you know why? Because they implemented the full stop and due obedience laws. The president we have now is doing something different. We no longer have an enemy. This march is the last one. If the enemy returns, we will return for as many years as is necessary. We're going to hold an important march on March 24th. We'll continue to fight in the plaza every Thursday. We'll continue to tell the government what we think is right and what's wrong. But we think that it's a different moment in Latin America.
In her final remarks yesterday, Hebe de Bonafini said that the Mothers will continue to prepare a future generation to carry on with the legacy of defending human rights and demanding justice. is the 30th anniversary of Argentina's military junta NIRS, human rights groups are preparing a series of events to commemorate the 30,000 disappeared. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Búsquenme a orillas del mar, besando la espuma y la sal. Búsquenme, me encontrarán en el país de la libertad.
Free Speech Radio News would like to correct and clarify several misstatements made during our December 29th broadcast. The story in question looked at the history of wrongful termination and sexual harassment lawsuits filed against American Apparel and the company's CEO, Dev Charney. In the broadcast, FSRN reporter Leilani Albano stated that Mr. Charney was 35 years of age. He's 36. She stated that the company was founded in 1977. It was founded in 1997. We reported that the company earned $200 million in profits. American Apparel says it has achieved $200 million in revenue. The report also stated that Charney had faced charges of criminal sexual misconduct. In fact, all previous lawsuits brought against Charney, including the current case pending against him in Los Angeles Superior Court, have been civil suits. After reading court documents listing charges against Charney that include, quote, conducting business meetings in his underwear and parading in a penis and ball cover during meetings, close quote, the reporter misinterpreted a statement given by the public relations firm representing Charney as corroborating those charges. The actual statement from the PR firm reads, quote, American Apparel manufactures underwear as well as other garments, and Charney, as a fit model for the company, sometimes wears these garments and others, as is entirely natural and appropriate in a fashion business. End quote. Referring to an interview with anti-sweatshop organizer Trina Toko, the report paraphrased a broad statement about oppressive conditions of women workers globally and implied that Toko's statement described working conditions at American Apparel. In fact, Toko was not describing conditions at American Apparel. However, Toko did describe charges of union busting activity against American Apparel that were considered by the National Labor Relations Board. Those charges are no longer pending against the company.
Well, now this is Utah Phillips, and I'm down here in Albuquerque, and I listen to Free Speech Radio News because I need to know the truth, and I can't get it from the top down. I get it from the people who are on the street, like the gentleman I'm talking to right now.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent production produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Rousseau. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. If you have comments or questions, please email us at comments@fsrn.org. Sitting in for Out of Bogato, I'm Nell Abram in Tampa, Florida.